Had it. So, I was thinking of speaking a little bit about, you know, what it means to be a brahmachari or a monk in today's world from a broader perspective. Firstly, within the world today, then specifically within our tradition. I don't know much about your present situation, but essentially the challenge is similar everywhere. So I'll talk about that, and then I'll talk a little bit about studying Shastra, because my primary source of strength and service is centered around Shastric studying, speaking and writing. So, in general, throughout history, there are always people who have above average spiritual urges. Because above average spiritual urges may come just naturally. As Vishwanath Chakur says, there are two ways that this adhyatmic pravritti comes. He says, swabhavaki and balen utpadita. Swabhavaki means naturally, that means from a previous life. That person has had some connection with God and wants to move onwards. And the second is balen utpadita. Somebody meets a very inspiring person, a great saint. And that brings out the spiritual inclination. So, when there are people with above average spiritual urge, then how is that to be harmonized with the remaining social structure? In general, two systems have been there in the world. One is division of lifespan, and second is division of society into groups of people. And in the Vedic tradition, both have been done to some extent. So division of lifespan means, in most religious traditions, like nowadays, marriage is like a treadmill that people keep climbing on again and again. Now, one marriage doesn't work, try a second marriage. Second marriage doesn't work, try a third marriage. But in the past, you know, people would marry, and usually if a spouse dies, you know, if a person becomes a widow or a widower, most people would not want to marry again. They would understand, okay, this life, let me focus on God. It's not that everybody is spiritually inclined. No, definitely not. But the understanding was that there is a purpose to life beyond just forming relationships in this world. And so the idea was, okay, you have a householder life and then you focus more on God. They may not, in the world's most majority religion is Christianity. And Islam is not very relevant for our discussion. So I'll primarily focus on how this monasticism is understood in the Christian world and how it is understood in Dharmic traditions. Dharmic traditions include Vaishnavism also, and to some extent, what is influential today is Buddhism. To some extent, there are impersonalists also who are monks. But I'll just contrast the two of them, and then I'll talk a little bit about the situation. So, in the Catholic tradition, the idea was that, okay, this relationship is over, focus on God. And they would have monks and nuns. And that's how people focused on their relationship with God by dividing life into phases. So either a partner dies and then you focus more on God, or you finish your duties. They may not have a formal division like Vanaprastha and Sannyas ashrams. But the understanding was that the later part of life should be devoted to God. Now, for others, there is also the division. So one is chronological division. The other is sociological division, where some people become monks right from childhood. Not childhood, maybe youth. And then they live separate from society. And in the Catholic tradition, the monks are considered extremely important. Because they said that even today in most Catholic churches, they say that the rituals of sanctification, sacraments they call them, they have been performed by monks. And the fathers, usually pastors, main pastor is always a monk. And they say that because the monk has renounced the connection of relationship in this world, has sacrificed the pleasure of flesh for the service of God. So the pastor stands above the congregation and becomes the link between God and the congregation. And that's why the sacraments means they have certain rituals, And just like, you know, in we have, say, we have the Japamala, but at the time of initiation, the spiritual master chants the mantra. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that the spiritual master invests the holy name in the mantra and gives to the disciple. So, like that, they have the idea of sacraments. And the sacraments can be invested by the monks. That's why in the Catholic tradition, they have that the main pastor has to be a monk. Now, there has always been a reaction to this. Whenever there's monkhood, we'll come to this in the Dharmic traditions a little later. In the Christian tradition, especially in the medieval ages, some of the top leaders in terms of the monks, but they often became morally corrupt. And there are several popes, you know, who not only had sex, they had sex with a variety of women, many women, and they had many illicit children also through that. So as a reaction to this, and many other problems in the Catholic Church, Protestantism came up. There's a Catholic, the Christian Reformation. And one of the trends within the Protestant movement is that monkhood is a source of great evil. Because when people become monks, then they are suppressing their natural urges. And therefore, they end up doing terrible things. So, in most Protestant denominations, they don't have any monks at all. So, they're all pastors are couples. And Protestantism also spreading, but Protestantism has largely been more this worldly. Because in general, if in a congregation there are not people who are totally devoted to God, then the focus on God as a goal distinct from this world gets diminished. Because those who renounce the world, they have no goal in this world. And seeing their example, people feel inspired also to seek another otherworldly goal. So it is during this, when this Reformation was going on, though the Protestants and Catholics, they all got different countries as their heads. So Italy, Spain, Portugal, these are Catholics. France, Britain, Germany, they're Protestants. And there was severe war. So many of the Protestants, because the Catholic Church was still very powerful, they fled. And they came to America. And they developed America. Now, because Protestantism had rejected many of the evils in Catholic Church, but along with that, they also rejected the monasticism. So their ethos became very worldly. And the Protestant Church very much embodies the values of Dharma Artha Kama. Their idea is, our worldly success proves our godliness. Because we are so godly, so God is giving us all this prosperity. So in fact, the British Church also rationalized like that. Because they had the Anglican Church, which is also a Protestant Church. And they had the idea, because we are so richly devoted to God, that's why God is blessing us by enabling us to conquer so many parts of the world. So in general, when the religion rejects the monastic order, then it becomes quite worldly. Like Prabhupada said in the first canto, first chapter itself, that in Dharma Artha Kama, if people find that they can get Artha without Dharma, then they give up Dharma also. So over a period of time, America became very prosperous. And to some extent, the Protestant ethos is that God's glory is seen in the prosperity that we achieve in this world. And because of that, the Protestants do work hard in this world. And we see the effect of the westernized culture. In the westernized culture, we see that people are materially very well organized. Now, even if most of you come from India, you see that if you go to India, things seem to be so materially mismanaged. So one of the things that around 1890 century, when Ralph Waldo Emerson and others read Bhagavad Gita, and they appreciated it. There are many spiritual aspirants who came to India. And when they saw the poverty, the misery, the mess in India, they just couldn't link how are these people so lofty in their thoughts and so filthy in their lives. The philosophical insights in the Upanishads, in the Gita, they are so lofty. It's so completely messy in their life. How is this? What happened? Just couldn't digest it. I'll come to this point again later.
But the point I'm making is that in general, most religions, Christianity, Catholic Church has its influence even today, but Protestants have spread much, much more. They are quite strongly evangelical, much more than the Catholic Church. And the Protestant ethos is largely dharmartha kama. And that's why religion today is largely reduced to the idea that it is something which will keep you moral, keep you good, so that you can have the good life. The good life means, as they say, the good life they call in America is, you have a nice family, you have a nice job, you have a nice home, a nice children. That's a good life. And religion is primarily meant to contribute to the good life. And Islam, of course, I won't go deeply into it. Islam is radical, at least mainstream Islam, is radically against monk code. There are many reasons for it. The main challenge which Islam faces is that in most religions, certainly in the Vedic tradition, the spiritual power and the political power were always kept separate. The Brahmanas had spiritual power, the Kshatriyas had political power. Even in Christianity, the spiritual power was Jesus, the political power was primarily with Paul. Paul was one of his apostles who actually spread Christianity very far and wide. But in Islam, the center of spiritual power and political power was the same, Muhammad. And subsequent generations of Muslims, they were all looked up to follow Muhammad. But they have followed primarily his example of political power, not the example of spiritual power. So Muhammad would go to caves and meditate on God. That sort of thing very few people do. See how Muhammad planned and schemed and conspired to win territories. What he did, whatever it took to win the land for Allah. That's what they follow. So, because Islam is largely this worldly, because it has followed Muhammad's primarily political example, so in Islam, there is not much monkhood. Now, coming to the dharmic traditions. In the dharmic traditions, if you see in Varnashram, both divisions are there. There is division chronologically of life, and there is also in terms of demography itself. Some people can be monks, and some people can be householders. So, when Srila Prabhupada, if you see within the Gaudiya Sampradaya, coming specifically to our Sampradaya, that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself was sannyasi, but none of his followers took sannyas directly. If you see, broadly speaking, the Bengali and Odia Vaishnavas, they're mostly grihasthas, almost everyone. And the Vrindavan Vaishnavas were mostly sannyas, renunciates. But originally, because Rupa and Sanatan Goswami had circumstantially converted to Islam, so according to the caste standards at that time, they were not eligible for sannyas. Because they had become sort of, in the conventional Brahminic life, they had become contaminated. So then they had renounced the world, but the Brahminical standards held that they could not take sannyas. So then they took an alternative form of renunciation, that is Babaji. And because they were the foremost among the renunciates, among Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's followers, subsequent generations of renunciates felt that if they have not taken sannyas, if they have taken only Babaji sannyas, Babaji Vesh, then we should also take Babaji. So that's how, in the Gaudiya tradition, rather than the sannyas ashram, although Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did take sannyas, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu never specifically banned sannyas, but it was the Babaji Vesh rather than sannyas which became more standardized. And it was for the first time sannyas ashram was reinstituted within our sampradaya of Bhakti Sanskrit. Now there are various reasons for that. As I said, that first the Protestants came to India, and after the Catholics also came to India. And the Catholics had, when the Catholics started evangelizing in India, they had their monks and they had their nuns. And especially the nuns, they did, even some of you may have been convent schools, they would have principals who are usually nuns, or some teachers who are nuns. So they basically brought a lot of respect for an organized, renounced order. The Babaji's were disorganized. And then before that, Swami Vivekananda went to Chicago, and he sort of presented the whole Chicago conference, University,
that was there where he said, my dear brothers and sisters, and he was very appreciated. That was actually done because the Christians wanted to glorify their own religion. But what happened, he brought a lot of respectability for monkhood, for the sannyasa specifically. Not just in the Western eyes, but even in India. Because for Indians, if anybody is respected in the West, then that person becomes very respectable. So then Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur took that circumstance that because of the Christians, Christian renounced orders, as well as the impersonalists getting some respect. Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur took that and he reintroduced, or rather, not reintroduced, recommenced. It was already there, but he recommenced the renounced order in our sampradaya. And then he gave sannyas to many of his disciples. And then, of course, he had disciples who were grahasthas and disciples who were sannyasis. Now, when Srila Prabhupada went to the West, he started the ashrams. Now, if you see within the Krishna conscious movement, there is, as of now, we have, Prabhupada wanted Varanashram. But how the Varna division is to be made, that is very unclear for most people. But how it is going to be done is not known. As far as the ashram division is concerned, the Brahmachari, Grahastha and Sannyas ashrams are clear. Vanaprastha is still not so clear. Sometimes there are informal Vanaprastha who just renounce, just get retired from their job and work from their home. Some people are official Vanaprastha where they wear saffron and they don't no longer stay in their home but stay in a temple or some other ashram. But the Brahmachari ashram plays in ISKCON a substantially different role than what was played originally in the tradition. Originally, Brahmacharis are meant to be students. But within the Krishna consciousness movement, Brahmacharis soon become teachers. So now, this is for many reasons. Most of it is that necessity. That we live in a preaching movement and there are not many teachers available. So, relatively speaking, Brahmacharis are likely to have more time than grahasthas to study scripture, to understand and to teach scripture. So, now, when we live in today's society, see, as I said, going back to the Catholics, now more and more there's an increasing demand in the Catholic Church that scrap the need that the main pastor has to be a monk. Because there are many churches where there is no monk available. So who will do the sacraments at that time? So overall, the renounced orders are facing challenges, whichever part of the world it may be, or whichever religion it may be. But within Krishna consciousness, we have the advantage that, although the principle of bhakti may be there in other religions, but the principle of bhakti gives a very strong higher taste, easily accessible, relatively easily accessible higher taste, by the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, through the process of Krishna Bhakti as he has revealed. And that higher taste is a great strength. Ravindra Sarup Prabhu once, he has written a very nice article, How I Was Saved from Being Saved. So he writes about how once he was invited to address a Catholic seminary or a Christian seminary, where there were these boys, young boys, who were trained to become pastors, priests. And they were supposed to be monks. And he gave a brief talk. And he saw that, you know, when he told them about chanting of the Holy Name, they were ready to chant. So he saw they were sincere spiritual seekers. And then, so he gave his talk, finished the talk. And then after that, the class got over and a few of them stood around him to talk with him. And then suddenly he noticed one of them took out a cigarette and started smoking. These were supposed to be fathers, monks, and they started smoking. And as they're talking, Rajasuru just casually asks, is it so difficult for you to give up this smoking? So he said, I was shocked by the reply and the vehemence with which he gave the reply. So this pastor, he said, if I could just take a girl out on Saturday night, I wouldn't have smoked this damn thing. So then he asked, he said that, yes, there are brahmacharis in our movement also, but he had never experienced such vehemence towards the restriction. Then he inquired about their life.
And he writes in their article that, you know, he said, I felt pity for them when I heard about their lifestyle. He said that they had some classes in the morning, some classes in the evening, and most of the day was free. And in their monastic houses, they had television, they had magazines, and there was, although they were expected to be not having sexual contact, there was no rigid structure for restricting their interaction with women. And of course, there was nothing sattvic about their diet. They would eat meat. They would take wine also. So he said, with such stimuli, it is impossible for anyone to be celibate. So I felt that they were being cheated. Cheated not by any system intentionally, but they were being, they had a sincere spiritual urge, but they were not being provided a facility where that spiritual urge could be expressed. If a person is given idle time, if a person is given exposure to all sorts of media where there's going to be sensory stimulation, there's no regulation in diet. See, celibacy can, or monkhood, but brahmacharya cannot be divorced from the lifestyle. The whole lifestyle is materialistic. And then you said, okay, just one change is be a celibate. And it's not just one change that can be done like that. It doesn't work. So he says, how I was saved from being saved, because see, his childhood, he was also initiated. And Christians, they have, when you accept Jesus as your savior, then they say you are saved. He said, if I had been saved at that time, I would have become like them. But by Prabhupada's mercy, I was saved from being saved. Double quotes. Second quote, second saved is double quotes. So the point which I'm going to make is that actually we have the facility to gain access to the higher taste and to not only protect but to grow in our devotion and renunciation. But we have to take advantage of that facility. That means many things. But most importantly, it means that, you know, we have to take responsibility for our spiritual advancement. And we have to do what it takes for us to grow in our spiritual life, to protect our renunciation and to move forward in our renunciation. We can't... Yes, there is a supportive system, and in different temples, the level of support might be less or might be more. Now, there is a circumstantial element to it, and there is a transcendental element. Circumstantially, yes. Yesterday I was talking with Gopalandesh Guru. He said, now, the way brahmacharis have to live here, the way brahmacharis live in India, it's like brahmacharis are protected babies in India. Here you are like out, much more exposure. But so that is circumstantial. Of course, there are temptations there also, no doubt. And there is protection here also. But relatively speaking, there may be more challenge here, and that could be at one level circumstantial. The culture here is different. The temple's emphasis may be different. The service requirement may be different. But beyond the circumstantial, bhakti also means to see the transcendental. If you only see the circumstance, then how are we different from materialists? Materialists also see the circumstances. That means we understand that beyond the circumstantial arrangement, there is a transcendental arrangement of Krishna. That means Krishna has allowed the situation to happen, and if I try to serve Krishna in the situation, Krishna will enable me to grow. So, in general, in our life, many things may be wrong, many things will go wrong in future. At such times, ask not why this, ask how now. Ask not why this means, why is this facility not there, why it like this, why it is like that, why did this happen, why is this devotee like that. The why questions, especially with respect to the situations that we face in the world, they really don't have any lasting answers. We can say it's because of karma. But that's not a very satisfactory answer in terms of giving us solace. But if you just shift to how now, okay, this is the situation I am in, how best can I serve Krishna in this situation? Then that can actually help us to shift our mental focus from resentment to opportunity. Why this, then this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. We feel resentful because of that. How now? Okay, this is a situation. How can I serve Krishna in this situation? And then when we move forwards, one of the most inspiring aspects of bhakti is that when we try to serve Krishna, then we actually see the truth of Dadami Buddhi Yogam Tam Yena Mama Payantite. Krishna will give us intelligence how we can move closer to Him. How we can try to serve Him more and more. How we can find forums by which find opportunities. So for example, as brahmacharis, we may have a desire to study Shastra, but you don't have time, say. But then if you have the desire, Krishna will, you will find this, you maintain the desire, and suddenly some change will happen, some circumstance will come about, and you will get more time, more opportunity. It may not happen immediately, but it will happen. So, circumstance can limit our actions, but unfortunately, we let circumstance weaken our intention itself. It means, I have a desire to study Shastra, but I have so many services, I don't have time. So circumstance may weaken my action. But when we get frustrated by circumstance, then we let it weaken our intention itself. I'll never be able to study Shastra. And then, when we don't have desire, then why should Krishna reciprocate? So, rather than blaming the circumstance or being resentful of the circumstance, we see beyond the circumstantial to the transcendental. We see that then we will, over a period of time, find out opportunities and Krishna will change the situations or Krishna will give the intelligence to work within the adaptive existing situations to move onwards towards Him. I'll give a couple of examples of this. Both ways. You know, I had polio from my childhood. One of the main hesitations I had in joining Brahmacharya Ashram was whether I would be able to maintain the pace. The lifestyle of Brahmacharya Ashram is quite austere. That's what devotees also asked me. Our temple president, Radhishyampur, asked me, will you be able to manage this? I said that yes. I never needed any special facilities when I was in school and college. At that time, I was much healthier. So then for my first 10-11 years, I lived in the ashram itself. And with whatever facilities, other devotees had same facilities. But then afterwards, I had an accident where I slipped and fell, my leg practically broke apart. And after a doctor told, now you cannot move around much. So earlier I used to travel quite a lot and preach and give classes. Doctor told, you cannot travel so much. So I was thinking, that time I was doing some writing, but writing was not my main service. My main service was traveling and preaching. I was wondering, what will I do if I don't travel and preach? Then I was in India, there's a Bhaktivedanta hospital run by devotees. So I was in that hospital, and through the hospital, I was giving a class on Skype. There were some students in Bangalore. I was giving a class. And while giving, I was speaking on the six opulences of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And I just closed my eyes and just kept speaking. And I spoke for 15, 20 minutes almost. And then suddenly, I heard the Skype call ringing. And I opened my eyes, and then I realized that about a minute after I closed my eyes, the internet connection had gone. And for 15-20 minutes, I had been speaking and there was no audience. Now my initial reaction was, I wasted my time. But then somehow, Krishna mercy, I got the thought. I was in ecstasy speaking about Krishna. I was absorbed. So it struck me, for speaking about Krishna, I don't need an audience. So that gave me the idea that I used to answer questions. I used to, whenever I would go to any place, one of my main services was not just giving classes, but answering questions. So I thought, so many people have questions, I can just record their answers and put them on the net. So at that time, no one was doing that like that. But I started that and I got such a huge response. And then I started the Bhakti Shastri course, which is online. And then I started giving lectures also directly online, which then devotees use for, like this PK movie had come. So then I just gave some answers and many devotees found it very useful. So, you know, when I got the fracture, I did not know that I would start online preaching afterwards. But I just had a desire to glorify Krishna. And somehow, at that time also, now I think back, a normal human reaction would have just frustrated, 15 minutes wasted away. But somehow Krishna gave that intelligence at that time, Dadami Buddhi Yogam Tam. I was just able to think in a different way. So, in general, if we try to serve Krishna, if we don't let our circumstance weaken our intention, then Krishna will facilitate the fulfillment of our intention. and our intention is devotional, somehow Krishna will reach. Maybe not immediately, maybe it may take some time. But Krishna will work it out. And unfortunately, the nature of the mind is that it just wants some excuse to make us lax in our bhakti. So then it will find immediately circumstances. Hey, this is the problem. How can you be serious in this situation? And once we lose our seriousness, then the problems increase more and more. Because then when we lose our seriousness, then we don't get higher taste. Once we don't get higher taste, then again the lower tastes are rising more and more. And then the inner battle becomes quite unbearable. So, overall, with respect to coming to, I'll not go much into that, but I'll come to the point of Shastric study. For us, there will be many different services. And again, one of the challenges of the mind is that it will complain, oh, you don't have time to study Shastra, you don't have time to study Shastra, you don't have time to study Shastra, you have so many services. But then, suppose we were given a full day with nothing to do, just study Shastra. And within 1 or 2 hours, the mind will get bored. This is too much, you can't do it. So, although I like to read, I like to study, but I also cannot just study throughout the day. You know, I have to write, I have to speak, I have to do some variety. So, there are very, very few devotees who, if all their service were taken away and they were just given the service of studying Shastra, you would be able to sustain it. That means, the same mind which now blames us, you have too many services, so you're not able to study Shastra, the same mind will later trouble us, oh, you know, life is, Brahmacharya life is so boring, all day study. Oh, how will you continue that? You need some variety, isn't it? So, that means, the mind will find reason to be dissatisfied whatever the situation. If we have too many services, the mind will find reason to be dissatisfied and you don't have time to study Shastra. And if we have a lot of time to study Shastra, hey, Shastra is so boring, you know, again. We may not say it directly, but the purports keep saying the same thing again and again. That's how many times I have read this. And if I study something technical also, people are not intelligent enough to understand it. So why should I trouble my intelligence trying to understand it also? So basically, the mind will always find some reason to keep us dissatisfied. So rather than listening to the mind, if we just focus on using the time that we have, whatever time we have, we use it to study Shastra, then we will find that Krishna will arrange according to our need, according to circumstance, to give us more facility for studying and teaching Shastra. And we can study Shastra for various purposes. Of course, I said the primary role of Brahmacharis in our movement is as teachers. But not everybody will necessarily become a teacher of the same kind. Some devotees may become teachers who study Shastra and teach the Bhakti Shastri, Vaibhav, Bhakti Vaibhav. They really go deep into Shastra and they teach Shastra. Others may become teachers where their focus is not so much on going deep into Shastra, but on cultivating people, on developing a relationship, on building a program where what you need more is capacity to understand and present the basic concepts and then build relationships. So different devotees may grow in different ways. And one challenge with respect to, this applies not only to studying Shastra, but in general to anything is that when we live in very close quarters, then often, because we are observing others, we just can't avoid comparing ourselves with others. The mind just compares. And then we may feel, oh, this devotee studies Shastra so much. This devotee is not studying anything. This devotee is in this position of, this devotee is in this managerial position. This devotee doesn't have any position. So often, we get caught up in externals too much. When we come to the ashram, yes, if we can compare others to gain inspiration. Every morning, this devotee wakes up and does sadhana very strictly. Let me also try to do that. That is fine. That is good. But that comparison is either making us feel insecure or is making us feel envious about another person. Or third possibility, it makes us feel superior to another person. Then that sort of comparison is detrimental for our bhakti. Although we are living together, ultimately each of us has a relationship with Krishna. So for example, with this Shastric study, how study of Shastra will inspire you will be different from how it will inspire me. So for me, say it may be reading the Sanskrit, understanding the Sanskrit words, memorizing the verses. That's what may inspire me. For you, it may be that
you get your primary inspiration by from hearing the classes of your spiritual master. For someone else, it may be hearing systematic classes in a particular course. You know, Bhakti Shastri from beginning to end you hear. That's what inspires you. For someone else, Shastri study may inspire in a different way. You just read one purport and contemplate on it and analyze it. And somebody, I know one devotee, you know, for every 15 minutes that he reads, he writes down for 5 minutes. Prabhupada said, you know, you present your message in my words. And my message in your words. So what he says is that, he doesn't feel as if I have studied and understood Shastra, still I write it down. So he feels very nourished. So he did read only 15 minutes, but after reading 15 minutes, 5 minutes, he will write down in his own words, what are they read? And he feels, yes. When I try to write down, then I am forced to think, what is it that I read? And it becomes more thought-provoking, more absorbing. And at the end of that reading, he feels, now I got something which I can talk with others, which I can use in my classes. So there need not be any stereotype. Like somebody would say that, oh, this person, we joined together, but he's in the 7th canto, I'm only in the 2nd canto, right? Well, when we are going to die, Krishna is not going to ask which canto are you on. Krishna is going to ask whether we are remembering Krishna. Certainly we want to read Bhagavatam, we want to read CC. But the important point is, not just how much we read, but on how much what we read inspires us. How much what we read transforms us. How much what we read energizes us so that we can practice bhakti and share Krishna with others. So that's why if you find that some devotees can read very fast and you have to read slowly, there's no need for such comparisons. If that devotee reads fast, fine. Some devotees may be able to memorize a lot of verses. And we find that, you know, for me to memorize verses is a big headache. Well, yes, some verses it's good to memorize. But it's not that memorizing verses itself is necessary. The important Prabhupada was Prabhupada, devotee asked Prabhupada, should we study Sanskrit, Prabhupada? So, Prabhupada encouraged some devotee scholars to study Sanskrit. So, if that is one's interest, that is one's service, that's good. But Prabhupada said otherwise, he said, you know, there are these Gujarati baniyas, businessmen. So, you know, they know that their sons, their grandsons, they are going to continue their business. And they have flourishing business, they earn a lot of money. So then they say, that it was at that time, it may not be true now. He says, even when you send them to school, he says, their goal is not to make them doctorate in mathematics. You should know enough math so that you can count your money. So he said, like that, you should know enough Sanskrit so that you can recite verses. You don't have to become a Sanskrit pandit. So certainly Prabhupada was not disapproving. My point is that, it's not that we have to memorize verses or we have to learn Sanskrit in order to advance in bhakti. If you can do it, and if you feel inspired to do it, wonderful. But if you can't, or it becomes, rather than being an inspiration, it feels like a burden. Then, it's for our basic, if you go Bhakti Shastri course, you have to memorize some verses. That's fine, but you don't have to go beyond that. So, we all have different abilities. And some devotees have certain abilities more visibly than others. Some devotees are able to sing very nicely. Some devotees are able to speak very fluently. Some devotees are able to be so organized. 1, 2, 3, 4. So, we can all see around us. And if we all go through different moods. Now, when we are proud, we will see, oh, I am better than this person. I am better than this person. I am better than this person. The mind works in such a way, whichever anartha it presently has, it magnifies that. So, if an artha of pride is there, I will see all the reasons how I am better than others. And if the anartha of, say, depression, I am going through depression right now. And all that I will see, hey, this devotee is better than me in this, this devotee is better than me in this, this devotee is better than me in this. I am good for nothing. I am good for nothing. So, I will conclude with this last point. Humility, sometimes say, I am so fallen. So, our ego is so subtle, that even when I say I am so fallen, the ego shifts our focus from fallen to I. So, what starts off as humility ends as self-pity. So, we just become self-centered. Oh, things are so bad with me. I am this, I am that. And Krishna doesn't see. If Krishna had wanted talented people to be his devotees, Krishna would have inspired all talented people to become his devotees. Krishna would have inspired given all of us talents. Krishna wants our heart. Krishna doesn't necessarily need our talents. The talents are there, we can use them. And if you don't have them, actually all of us have some talents, we just have to discover them. But some devotees may have visibly more talents, others may have visibly less. It doesn't matter so much. As far as our service is concerned, our connection with Krishna is concerned, that doesn't depend on what talent we have. It depends on whether the intention to serve Krishna is there. So basically the best way to avoid comparison is by remembering our purpose. If our goal had just been to, to become the number one in some field, I want, then we could have well continued in our careers and tried to become number one there. But now that we have come here not to become number one, we have come here to become Krishna, become devotees of Krishna. So while serving Him, if Krishna makes us the number one book distributor, Krishna makes us the number one kirtaniya, Krishna makes us the number one speaker, that's fine. But that's we'll accept that as His mercy, as a further facility by which we can serve Him more. But that's not what we need to do. So this is one major challenge when we live in close quarters, that we can get into this high, excessive comparison mentality. But if we avoid that and focus on whatever we have and use it in Krishna's service, we can actually march on quite nicely. I'll summarize if there are any questions. I started mainly by talking about how for people with above average spiritual urges, either there's a chronological division of human life or there's a sociological division of society. And I talked about how the Catholic and the Protestants, how they split apart. One of the reasons was Catholics accepted the monks where the Protestants didn't. And the point of that discussion was that all over the world, so in Protestant monasticism was already eliminated, when in Catholicism it is right now under attack. And other religions like Islam doesn't have it. So in our tradition, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took sannyas, after that Babaji Vesh, and from Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur again, sannyas, and then the saffron cloth basically. Babaji Vesh essentially means white cloth, but with a particular kind of dress. And the saffron cloth came back again with Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur. And in Srila Prabhupada, the way he instituted ISKCON, it was mostly in a culture where people had no spiritual knowledge. So, in Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur's time, it was sannyasis were teachers, brahmacharis were assistants. But in ISKCON, quite often the brahmacharis themselves have to be teachers. So we are in a different situation. And although the challenges may be more for us, we understand that behind the challenges is Krishna. And the greater the challenge we face and go through, the greater is the reward that Krishna will give us. So in that sense, there is opportunity for greater advancement when there is greater difficulty. And then I discussed about two main aspects. One is about the focus on not letting our circumstance weaken our intention. That if we have the intention, Krishna will eventually give the circumstance by which we can serve Him. And then I talked about how avoiding comparison by knowing that we have not come here to gain some position, even some material position within a spiritual service. We come here simply to learn to grow spiritually, to learn to love Krishna. And that's why if we avoid that comparison, then we can actually move peacefully. And I talk especially about that, how we have the facility for getting higher taste. I talk about how I was saved from being saved. But we have to take responsibility for tapping that facility, by which we can keep ourselves absorbed in Krishna and move onwards. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yes, please.
Brahmacharis, sometimes we may have superiority complex, like we are better than Grahasthas. But then when that pride comes, then we can't please Krishna, because we hear denial of information, or people have that attitude. So how to correctly see Grahasthas and stay humble as a Brahmacharis?